Welcome to another episode of Profiles in Leadership with Steve Anderson. In today's interview, we have a very accomplished and brave physical therapist and business owner in Jeff Ostrowski. Jeff is a graduate of the Thomas Jefferson University Physical Therapy Program of 1986. He is the founder of Excel Physical Therapy, which he started in 1990. He is the managing partner of ENA Therapy. ENA Therapy owns clinics under the brand names of Excel Physical Therapy and Apex Physical Therapy. His volunteer positions have been on the board of directors of the private practice section of the American Physical Therapy Association and its treasurer in 2017 and 2018. He was the managing editor of the PPS member magazine Impact between 2008 and 2011. He has also been active and held elected positions for the Pennsylvania State Chapter of the American Physical Therapy Association. He lives in Glen Mills, Pennsylvania, is married with two children, ages 21 and 18, and enjoys multiple sports, including fitness, cycling, golf, and loves to draw and read. Welcome to the show, Jeff. I really appreciate you being here today.
Yeah, it's good to be on, Steve. Hope you had a good weekend, and I'm looking forward to chatting with you today.
Excellent. So just let's start off by, what year did you go into business, and how did you get started?
Yeah, so I opened the practice in June of 1990, so it's quite a while now. Just had our 29th anniversary just last week, actually. I remember that day because I opened the practice on my anniversary date. It was my second wedding anniversary.
Oh, great. And,
so that was not a very smart thing to do, but it's just the way, the dominoes fell, and it worked out just fine. Luckily, I married someone who was super understanding, and worked out just fine. It's funny to laugh about it now, but I wouldn't recommend it to anybody out there to start a business on the day of your anniversary.
Okay, that's great. And then you grew the business over time and ended up with how many clinics before you did something different?
Yeah, well, now, as we sit here today, we have 35 clinics. You know, those were almost all organic growth. There was, I think, one or two acquisitions in there over the years. And, you know, just kind of just putting one foot in front of the other every day is really how we got to where we are today. Maybe some curious parts of the story of our growth is back in 2011, we had 13 clinics at that point, and we merged with another company, another private practice in the southeastern Pennsylvania area. And I believe they had 7 or 8 or 9 clinics at that point. And we did a complete stock merger at that point. Fascinating structure. There was no money or anything, no cash that changed hands during that. We just all pitched in equity and divided it up, you know, amongst the various owners from each company, the partners from each company. And then since that time, we've, you know, added another 15 or so clinics. So we've had really good success with that merger. It was a very interesting story. You know, if you want to dive into that, we can
sure,
a little
go
bit.
Go ahead. Yeah. Share with us.
Yeah, I think there's some really interesting aspects to it. There was a lot of merger and acquisition frenzy, you know, going on around that time in the late, you know, kind of around the 2009, 2010, 2011 area, much like we see today. And we considered a couple offers to sell the company back then, but, I had gotten to know the owners of the company that we merged with through a networking group of other private practices owners that we participated in the southeastern Pennsylvania area, and found myself just kind of gravitating towards them, towards one of the partners in particular who would generally attend these networking meetings. And, you know, we just seemed to see business on the same level and had visions of growth and had pretty good scalable systems already in place. So there were a lot of synergies between our two companies. They happened to have a really good operating model in their clinics. We had a really good marketing kind of model and already a very well-established brand in the market. So we kind of put those two strengths together and really rebuilt almost an entirely new company in combining, you know, the best of both worlds, if you will. And it was fascinating to go through that process because I think we had such enormous success with it that, you know, if I scratch my head and think, how do we do that? And yeah, I think that we were able to do it because there was kind of no pride of authorship and no egos involved. You know, we were humble and we were focused on a goal. And, you know, we didn't think we were always the smartest person in the room, and we were willing to, you know, be open and honest with each other and, you know, kind of just share and put best practices together. And it took us, you know, maybe a year and a half or so to like kind of integrate the companies. And then once we got that integration behind us, we just went really off and running on a growth strategy and had real good success with it. One of the beautiful things about it was because of, you know, our kind of leverage of our brand and our marketing, it, you know, really gave their clinics a gigantic boost. And then their operating model was super elegant and very, very focused on you know, patient experience and quality and outcomes. And when we put those two things together, we just got a huge financial lift and a huge brand lift, you know, really throughout the market. And finally, I think our leadership team, our clinic directors, you know, from both companies just trusted us. You know, they bought in and they trusted us. And, you know, they really worked together very cohesively over the years to, you know, to build up really a company that we're super, super proud of. So yeah, that's
what you've described there is just a real perfect example of, you know, collaboration, you know, collaborating to come up with something better than what each of you had. And that's the perfect definition of it. So I commend you for, as you said, not having to be the smartest in the room, but just putting your heads together and coming together and collaborating and come up with something better. That's really impressive.
Yeah. Well, thank you. Yeah. It's really fun to look back on now. I mean, there was a lot of hard work involved, but you know, the partnership team, we always, you know, have always really liked each other, gotten along superbly well, had a lot of fun in meetings, and we worked hard, but we were able to have a good time. And now I consider these folks to be, you know, amongst my best friends in the world. And you know, so it's really cool to, you know, feel very proud and very lucky to be a part of it.
And so what was your strategy and how did you get from kind of being in the day-to-day management of the business to being kind of more in a leadership capacity or a bigger management capacity with the bigger entity?
Yeah, well, I think the first thing that I had to do at one point back in the day was come to grips with the fact that I couldn't run the company and also be a physical therapist treating patients at the same time. So, you know, that's a bitter pill to swallow because I really enjoy treating patients. And I know there's many of my colleagues out there who might be listening to this that, you know, also really like that part of the job or maybe still like that part of the job and figured out a way to make it work. But we really wanted to kind of grow the company and scale it up there. And so some of it was a little bit of a leap of faith because the concern, of course, is that if you're not the guy treating patients, then the physicians are not going to refer patients to you anymore, and that pipeline will dry up. And then, of course, you have your patients, Steve, who, you know, have a loyalty to you individually as a physical therapist and are not inclined to see somebody else other than you when they come back for, you know, additional care when it's needed. But those are conversations that, you know, if you have built up trust and a good relationship with your physician and your patients over the years, you know, they're not easy to have, but they can be have. And, you know, we found that really everybody was very understanding of you know, what it took to grow a company, and they were fully willing to trust and cooperate, you know, with that transition. So that worked out, you know, better than expected. And then, you know, as we grew, of course, you know, you go through those growing pains where you have a lot of balls that you're juggling or plates in the air, pick your metaphor. And you realize that, you know, you can't keep all those balls in the air all the time. You need to start to build out some infrastructure around you, which is, you know, that's a challenge to do because, first of all, you've got to pick the right people, and then you've got to have training systems in place, and then you have to have, you know, trust and accountability built into the equation there where, you can kind of keep your eye on what's happening out there. But eventually, you know, in order to scale up a company, you have to build out a management team. And, you know, so it might be a half a step backward, you know, in terms of workload, and it might be a half a step backward financially because you have to pay these people. But we always looked at it as, you know, just investing in the future and you know, making sure that if you had the right systems in place and the right kind of training, and those people had access to you and whatever intellectual property and whatever kind of business wisdom you had in your or have in your brain, that was available to them. And, you know, through that kind of, you know, very methodical process, we were able to, you know, really build out a really excellent management team. And so that's how we did that. Now, if I could just elaborate on that a little bit,
sure, go ahead.
Some people out there too, is one of our goals when we merged the company back in 2011 was we thought that, you know, we would eventually put it up for sale, you know, within 5-7 years or something like that. And we really worked hard to kind of optimize our EBITDA all the time. And, you know, it was kind of always focused on what, you know, what's the valuation of the company and that sort of thing. But as time went on, we were having, you know, good success and we were really enjoying ourselves. And we kind of came to the realization that it didn't really make a lot of sense to sell the company outright because we would leave so much value on the table in terms of the growth trajectory of the company. However, because of kind of where the various partners were in life, we didn't necessarily wanted to keep working on a full-time basis, you know, to manage the company. So we embarked on a strategy to hire a professional management team, and the partners all kind of moved into a board of directors position and left day-to-day operating responsibilities for the company. And that team is really fully in place today. It was probably a year and a half to 2 year long process, you know, to go through the interview and hiring and training of those people. But back in about October of 2018, I was able to nearly fully retire from day-to-day responsibilities with the company. And now I really just help out with various special projects. And of course, I sit on the board of directors of the company, so I still have ownership of the company. But someone else does the day-to-day, you know, running. We have a CEO, a CFO, a team of regional directors, and some other, you know, kind of middle level management that have stepped in and taken over more or less what all the partners of the company used to do. So kind of fascinating story that, yeah. you don't have to grind yourself to death running a company. Or I guess what I'm saying is there's more options available to people out there. You know, you have the option of continuing to work if you really want to do that and like to do that, of course. Or you can sell the company, and we all know many people who have had gone through that experience. But there is sort of a third way, which is to bring on this management team, and it's worked out really, really well for us, and I'm really happy about the decision.
Well, that's really fascinating. But what comes to mind is how did your clinicians and how did the people within your company react to that outside management team? A lot would expect, they don't know PTs and they don't know the people, so therefore that would be a really hard transition. But sounds like it went well. Why do you think it went?
Yeah, it's interesting to, you know, kind of consider that question because one of the things throughout the interview process, and we started with the CEO's position first. That was our first hire. And it was really important kind of qualification for us that person understood and could relate to, kind of the life of the PT. And even though they're not a PT, our CEO is not a PT, she is a person who has a lot of the same kind of values and kind of attributes that, you know, a physical therapist would have, and, you know, altruism and wanting to help people and, you know, kind of caring about what you do and being a people kind of person and, you know, someone who can relate really well to others. And we found that person. So I think it started there. We also concurrent, you know, with that hiring process, Steve, we you know, we treat our leadership team here, our management team here, like grownups. And, you know, we went around and we had individual and group conversations with the entire management team. And in fact, with the entire company at one of our big all company meetings, told them really exactly what we were doing. We laid it out very, you know, matter of factly and laid out the timelines and the reasons why we were doing it and what the goals of the company were. And we were able to get, you know, really good buy-in from the team here. So I think, you know, kind of hiring the right leadership and then, you know, treating the current management team of the company with respect and bringing them in on, you know, the plan from right from the beginning, helped us immensely to affect a really smooth transition. Now, in all honesty, it wasn't without its hiccups. You know, anytime you're going to go through a major change like that, you know, you're going to run into some kind of, you know, bumps in the road. And we indeed did. You know, we've been able to work through those, as some of them are still kind of a work in process. You know, the current management team, they're not us. They're not the founders of the company. They're not the people that, you know, I literally hired probably 90% of the 160 or so therapists that work in this company. So, you know, when you go through that process with somebody, you develop a personal relationship with them. And,
right. You
know, that created a little bit of void, I guess, when I left the company. But I think our current new management team has done an excellent job of, you know, of building trust you know, kind of camaraderie and collaboration with the new management team. So I feel very optimistic about our future.
So Jeff, about 6 months ago, I think, or maybe it's even less than that, you had reached probably many of your professional goals and now we're headed for a life where you could really do whatever you wanted to do. And I believe after a visit to your doctor, eventually everything changed. What happened on that fateful day?
Yeah. Well, it was all that you said, Steve. I had from October on through really the end of January of 2019 had, you know, more or less retired, and I was really enjoying myself. Peggy, my wife, and I were taking some trips. We're empty nesters. Our kids were away to college. I was taking art lessons, learning how to draw and paint. Then towards the end of January, I started to develop some discomfort in my stomach, and I went to see my doctor, and eventually it ended up being diagnosed with pancreatic cancer, stage 4 pancreatic cancer. So that happened, I'll never forget this day forever, February 12th of 2019 was when I got that diagnosis. And, you know, really like everything changed at that point. I was able to... started chemotherapy treatment for that about 7 or 8 days after that diagnosis, and continue to receive chemotherapy that cancer at this point. It's obviously put a real damper on our, you know, kind of these retirement plans that we had, because being a chemotherapy patient is kind of like a full-time job. The way the process works is you literally sit in a chair with IVs dripping into you for about 8 hours on one day, and then you leave the facility with a pump that continues to pump additional chemotherapy agents into you for the next approximately 48 hours. And then you're kind of sick, you know, for the next couple of days after that. So it's really 5 or 6 days of a real horrific process. I joke about it a little bit, but the way I describe it to people is if you took your worst ever hangover and then your worst ever flu and you added those together and multiplied them by 3, that's kind of what the sickness sort of feels like, you know, when you're getting chemotherapy. So it's not a pleasant process.
Oh my gosh. Sounds horrible.
It's pretty horrible.
So Jeff, how do you go to a doctor's office for what you think is a routine office visit, and you come home? What do you tell your wife? What do you tell your family? I can only imagine what that must have been like.
Yeah, well, I remember when I got the phone call. So the way they diagnosed this is with a CT scan, and my physician called me later that afternoon after we got the results, and I could just tell by the tone of his voice that something was wrong. And he said, do you want to come into the office to have this conversation, or should we just have it over the phone? And I, you know, I'm like, have enough sort of self-awareness, I guess, to know that the news wasn't going to be good at that point. I said, well, just give it to me over the phone. And he told me, and I, you know, the first reaction that you have is just disbelief. Like, no, you've got the wrong guy. You know, then I walked downstairs and told my wife, and, you know, it's a very emotional, you know, kind of a moment where, you know, disbelief and sadness and anger and, just bitterness and, you know, really just about every emotion that you can think of, you know, kind of goes through your mind. And it really is all consuming. I literally, for the first, I'm going to say it was probably 6 to 8 weeks, Steve, I couldn't have a conversation with anybody without breaking down in tears. It was very difficult for me to turn on the TV and watch like a NBA Sixers game or something like that and see people in the stands, like enjoying themselves and having a good time. And this is a very overwhelming, you know, sort of like shock to your system. They just kind of have to live through that process. It's a little different emotionally now, you know, it's kind of a little bit more routine and whatnot. And maybe some of the rawness of it has worn off, but I do have my moments, you know, now where it's a struggle to confront, you know, the sort of the fear and the mortality and the, you know, some of the really poor statistical outcomes with this particular type of cancer. You know, it's kind of makes me a little sad, a little depressed on some days, but
it must, you know, it must just feel so unfair. I mean, you did everything right. I mean, you're a fit guy, you exercise, you eat correctly, you do all the things you're supposed to do, and then you get this blow.
Yeah, it's I've had that conversation with myself a lot. You know, I am sort of your prototypical physical therapist. I'm really into fitness. In fact, about 2 weeks before this diagnosis, one of the beauties of being retired is I could go to the gym every day and spend as much time there as I wanted to. And I really devoted spinning class, you know, cycling, indoor cycling. And I was at a particular class that I don't know if you know anything about spinning or any of your listeners do, but it gets super competitive and I'm a competitive guy. And I remember going to one class where there were three or four other really strong riders there that day that I was always trying to catch up to. And I happened to beat them that day, like a victory. I got like top of the podium and walked out of there. I did 100 push-ups and 50 pull-ups afterwards. And I just walked out of the gym and I ran into someone I knew. And they said, how are you feeling? And I was like, I've never felt better in my life. I feel absolutely like magnificent right now. And then, probably less than 3 weeks after that, I had this diagnosis. So it really snuck up on me. And that's the sort of tragedy and the unfairness of pancreatic cancer is there's no early detection for it. It's usually, you know, advanced to stage 4 by the time you're symptomatic enough to get it diagnosed. So, yeah, that's a sad part of the story. I mean, I'm still able to bike. I've got a Peloton now at home. I got that afterwards. I didn't want to go back to the gym and be around anybody who might be sick because you got to kind of be careful about your immune system and some of the vulnerabilities that you have there. But I still enjoy cycling, and I'll put a plug in for the Peloton. That's an awesome piece of equipment. So if anybody's looking for,
hey, I've got one. Food. I've got one too. They are awesome. I love it.
Yeah.
So gosh. So okay. And then this, you know, you've got this diagnosis, and then do you have that discussion? I mean, was the physician up front and gave you the odds and a timeline, or is it, just hopeful at this point? I mean, I don't know what to ask other than, you know, what does he say when he tells you that and then tells you what you can expect?
Well, the way that the oncologist phrases it is, you know, the survival rates are low. I forget what the exact number is, but I think the 2-year survival rate, I believe it is probably somewhere around 10%. You know, so that's not very encouraging, obviously. What the oncologist will usually say is, you know, because I'm such a fit guy and I'm pretty disciplined and kind of have a great support system in place with my wife and my family and all my friends, we could talk about that too in a moment, but you know, there's a likelihood that I could be one of the survivors or the one of the sort of better success stories. And, you know, so that's what I'm really, you know, kind of focused and optimistic and hopeful about right now. And, you know, there's, of course, there's always advances in treatment and, you know, new things that are being discovered out there. And I keep close tabs now via my network on some of the clinical trials that are underway out there. And, you know, there are some really good successes going on right now. I've happened to connect with two individuals who are several years post-diagnosis with the exact same diagnosis and a similar age and maybe not quite as robust of a physical status as I am in. And they're doing quite well, you know, 2-3 years out. So those are very encouraging as well. But the way the physician will usually describe it, just to get back to that, is, you know, their job is to extend the quality and quantity of life. And you know, so it's kind of put in those terms. I told my doc last week when I saw him, I was like, hey, listen, brother, I'm here for quantity. So, you know, forget about quality right now. Give me everything you've got. And we'll worry about that later. So that's my focus.
And do you find that, is the internet helpful in this, or is it just drive you crazy? Because I'm sure you're online trying to check things out. And I've often wondered, is, you know, you can go down dark holes in that.
Yeah, I try to stay off of the internet. I think if you get there, you're going to see mostly bad news. So I've shied away. One of the first things I told my kids when I told them, which was that was a tough day. I said, look, I don't want you guys going on the internet and looking around at this thing because you're going to see a lot of bad news. I'll be very honest with you, and mom will too. You know, so if you have questions, you know, we're the people to ask, and I'll get the answers right from the physician's mouth. I you know, just don't want you guys to expose yourself to, you know, the many, many horror stories that are out there, and they're plentiful. You know, let's focus on what's positive and what can be done, and, you know, and we'll just put one foot in front of the other that way. And, you know, I think from a leadership perspective, maybe just to tie it back to some of your earlier questions about the business side, is it's really the, you know, the, I think the job of a leader is just to get everybody unified and moving in the same direction in a very methodical way. And that's how we just try to phase it to our kids. Like, you know, one of the first thing I said to them is my expectation is that you guys are going to go back to school and do extremely well. And that's important to me. That will ease my mind and let me focus on what I have to focus on here. So they don't have to, you know, kind of worry about you and you getting lost in school and stuff like that. And, you know, I'm really proud of my kids.
Yeah, I guess that's my next question, is I was just, you know, sitting here thinking, is, have you sensed the relationship has changed? Are they more cautious? Are they, I'm sure they're afraid. You know, tell me, you said you're proud of them. So why are you proud of them?
Well, I think I'm proud of them because they did get back to work, and, you know, they took their schoolwork seriously and performed well there. And, you know, I have noticed a change in them, and I don't know if that change may be more me or more them. I don't really know, but I do notice more closeness with them. I'll tell you, my daughter, she, for the first 6 weeks or so, I don't think she was more just getting just a little emotional here about this, but I don't think she was, you know, more than 10 feet from me most of the days, which was really comforting and nice. And, you know, I think that they are, they're concerned and, you know, obviously, and they're, you know, they don't really know what, they're probably as fearful as I am in some ways.
Sure.
If not more so. Yeah. But good news is that mom did a good job of raising them.
I'm sure you both did. Yeah. Since this is a podcast on leadership, what did you learn as a leader that prepares you for this journey now?
There's a couple of things, Steve. I've been thinking about that. I think there's a couple of things. Number one is, it's honesty. I think a good leader is a person that is honest with people. And I've always tried to take that approach at work, you know, with people. And that includes the hard conversations, not just the easy conversations. So I think that being that way with my family, you know, with my extended family, with my friends, has really helped me, and it's helped everybody, you know, just kind of come to grips with the situation that we're in. I think some vision is important too, because, you know, as a leader in your company, you need a positive vision. The group, they will respond to vision, and that vision could be positive or negative, you know, or apathetic or anything in between. And I've always tried to be very positive at work, and I think that's been helpful as a leader at my job. And now with my diagnosis, I think just being positive and optimistic and hopeful, it also helps lift others around you. And let me tell you something that's important, because the support system is critical to a diagnosis like this. I cannot imagine, and I know there are people out there who go through this by themselves. I can't even comprehend that. I have been just absolutely astonished by the number of people that have reached out to me, the friends that I had throughout life. You know, I'm talking back to grade school in some cases, that have come back and offered encouragement and support and prayers and meals and soup and cupcakes and brownies and you name it. It's just been amazing, you know, to have that kind of support.
As a man, you know, we don't seem to make as many or as intimate friends as I think women do. And, you know, I just heard you say how important friends are. And so what advice do you have to other career men out there when you consider what you just said?
Yeah, I think you have to work at it. It's not easy. You know, you've got to pick up the phone and you've got to call people. You have to be vulnerable and open yourself up. I've always been very comfortable in my own skin in that way. I don't really mind, you know, if people think I'm strange or, you know, too out there or whatever, but I'm an emotional guy and I'm not afraid to, you know, to share that with others. And I actually find, Steve, that people gravitate towards that. They like that. It helps them come out, you know, of their own kind of fears and insecurities and whatnot, and express themselves. And I also think, along with that, being, you know, a good friend and a good listener, I think I've seen what you're talking about. Like, a lot of guys are maybe a little bit more narrow-minded or me-oriented or just focused on their careers or whatever. And I've always been a kind of guy that treats everybody the same. And I'm more interested in what other people have to say than what I have to say. I mean, I know what I know and I know what I think. I live with it every day, so I don't need to hear myself talk anymore. I'd rather hear somebody else talk. So I think that's probably an area where most of us could improve.
Those are just amazing points. I hope everyone really listens to that and re-listens to that, because I think you hit it right on. I think the fact that you have so many people coming to you now in your time of need is because of that groundwork you did years before. So it's real important. I think it's something we should all take to heart. And I think the key word in there was being willing to be vulnerable. You know, people do appreciate that and are drawn to that, as you said.
Yeah. Thank you.
So, Jeff, so you get up in the morning, what's your biggest challenge each day when you climb out of bed in the morning?
Well, there's a couple of things. I mean, the chemotherapy just absolutely devastates your system. So I've got to be, not to get too graphic with you here, but I got to probably be within like 20 feet of a bathroom for the first couple of hours every day. So that's number one. That kind of fouls up your day, because, you know, I was normally a morning person and now I got to deal with that. But, from there, there are days, Steve, where I feel 90 to 95% normal. Like, you catch me on a day like today, I feel like there's nothing I could do that you asked me to do today. So the kind of, the conflict that creates in your mind between, hey, I've got this like terminal disease, but yet I feel pretty much normal. That is hard to kind of get your head around. And it's interesting, because I've said to several people, you know, it's so consuming of your mind. Like literally 90% of my thoughts some days are about cancer and about, you know, kind of what the future is. I often wonder what the heck I thought of before this.
Well, it brings up what I was thinking and preparing for this today is, you know, in leadership philosophy, you know, everyone agrees that it shouldn't be all about you, and that from, you know, where you're standing now, how can it not be all about you? How can you not be totally consumed with thinking about yourself and where you're at? And you know, how do you get over that? Because I think that's kind of what you're saying. It's so consuming that it could totally consume you, and it could be all about you.
Yeah. I think that is something I'm going to try really hard to get better at avoiding that, because I don't think it's healthy to sit there and just perseverate over yourself all the time. I think that bleeds off, you know, into other people seeing that, and you know, it's hard. It's a challenge, because when you don't feel well and, you know, your mind is sort of messed up, you know, it's easy to kind of fall into those dark places and those, you know, those deep holes. But, you know, that's back to where the support system comes in. And I'm blessed. My wife is just an amazing woman. So.
Well, let's talk about that further, if I'm not getting too personal here. You know, in your marriage and in your family, has your role changed? Do you try and just maintain that same rhythm you've always had, or have you noticed a definite change in that role that each of you have?
Yeah, you know, at this point, I'm trying hard to maintain my same role. I think that that's an important thing for me to do, just to be as an example. Like, I don't want my family and my friends to think of me as somebody who's sick. I really, and I got that advice from my good friend, Matt. He told me that he's a cancer survivor. He's also a practice owner. And he said, you know, just make sure you get up every morning and like shave and put some nice clothes on, and, you know, don't lay around the house looking sick all the time. And I try to do, even on those really bad days, I really try to do everything I can that I used to do, you know, in terms of like, you know, just taking care of myself and getting my own stuff and cleaning up after myself and, you know, all those sorts of things. So I you know, really try to keep that role in place. I do notice that, you know, my family, my wife, they are more attentive, and they would do anything. They would stand on the corner or stand on their head over there in the corner if I asked them to. I'm not kidding. If it helped me, they're more attentive and they would do anything for me. And there are some times where you do have to humble yourself and say, hey, you know, I need your help today, or can you get me this? And you know, that's just all part of the team effort that it takes to get through something like this.
Yeah, well, thanks so much for sharing that with us. Yeah. You know, I know you love music, and as we've discovered over the years, our musical tastes are pretty similar. What does music do for you during a time like this? And how has your relationship with music changed?
Well, I was never really a lyrics guy, Steve. I just listened to the sounds. And maybe that's a male-female thing. I don't know. My wife knows the words to every song, and, you know, every special occasion we've ever had, she remembers the song that was playing and all the rest of it. I hear the sounds. However, I will confess that since this diagnosis, the lyrics have connected with me on many songs, and some of them are good and inspiring and uplifting and happy and hopeful, and some of them are heavy and dark and whatnot. So I've found myself not liking those heavy, dark songs maybe as much as I used to, and kind of gravitate more towards the, you know, to the other types, as the carefree kind of songs. For example, we were in Nashville a couple weeks ago with a group of close friends and family, and we went to see Eric Church, who's a kind of a crossover country sort of rock guy, and he's got a lot of kind of cool, happy songs and songs about living life and loving life, and that was an awesome night, you know, listening to Eric Church, who's got like a great attitude and style on stage, you know, so... So my relationship with music has changed that way. I do also enjoy, I finally have gotten my mind right, Steve, where I can sit down and read. I'm an avid reader, involved in a book club and so forth. But for a couple of months, I couldn't really concentrate even on reading. My mind was so occupied. But most recently, I've been able to get back into it. And I do enjoy sitting. We have a kind of little reading music room in our house and a good sound system in there. So I really enjoy listening to jazz and classical, especially for some reason, really connect with me right now. So it's kind of an interesting time of life that way.
So is there a particular song that really speaks to your feelings these days, or is there a particular book you're reading that has really resonated?
I can't think of a particular song that really resonates with me. Now I can't think of it. There's a lot that get me fired up. You know, you put some Metallica on and I'll be breaking furniture and stuff like that. That gets me pretty excited and whatnot. That's
cool.
I've been given a lot of books. I'm like an average reader myself, but I kind of gravitate towards more towards sort of history or fictional history books and some kind of current events, politics, you know, those sorts of things kind of pique my interest.
Yeah. That's, I ran across a great quote the other day and it said, music is what feelings sound like. I thought that was pretty cool.
Yeah. That's a great line. Eric Church has a line that he says, funny how a memory sounds like a melody.
Very true. Yeah. So now I assume you have been all over the board with emotions since this diagnosis. And from a leadership perspective, has your opinion changed on how your emotions should play into your leadership style?
Yes, it definitely has. I think it validated what I sort of already knew, but maybe wasn't as confident as I should be about it. I think it's okay to be emotional as a leader. In fact, I would encourage it to be emotional as a leader. I mean, you can't be rash and you can't be flying off the handle and so forth of people. But I think the authenticity of emotion really connects with people. And I think that has been, I don't assess myself a lot, but I have had some time to do that recently. I think that has been one of the reasons why as a leader, I've had some success in my life is that I've been authentic and emotional and real, with people and not hid that side of me. So I think that we need to disabuse ourselves of the idea that a leader can't be emotional. I think that's wrong. And I think probably especially men, are guilty of that to your earlier point. So don't be afraid to be emotional, guys and gals. I think it's an important part. It's just, kind of who you are is who you are, and it's okay. And, that's important.
I think it's a great point. I can remember times in my career when I've been in front of people and I'll try to say something and I'll get emotional. And gosh, I just hate that. It just tears me up that I got emotional in front of all these people. Yet afterwards, when you get through it and people come up to you and tell you, that's what makes you believable. That's what makes you, people want to embrace you. So, you don't want somebody up there, losing it all the time emotionally. But on the other hand, when you do show that and you are willing to be a little vulnerable in front of people, I do think that speaks to them. I think they see you as a real human being and somebody that has emotions just like they have.
Yeah, Steve, I couldn't agree more. And I recognize that in you as a leader. And I've been a big admirer of yours for a long, long time. And I've seen that side of you. And my partners here at work will make fun of me sometimes because I'll get up in front of a company meeting and, the tears come and the voice quivers and all the rest of it. But, some moments just call for it. You're so proud of your team and what they've done or whatever the reason is, it's just called for and it just comes out. And when it's authentic, I think it's really well received and makes people around you feel safe to express themselves too. And that's probably the most important part about it.
Yeah. So looking at your career from a leadership perspective again, what sacrifices have you made to be successful and what should you not sacrifice?
We were just talking about that recently with my family and a couple of my brothers and sisters were present. I was actually in Nashville. We were talking about it. I asked everybody, I said, well, like, were you the same person? Are you the same person today that you were 10 or 20 years ago? And everybody said yes, except for me. I said, there was a time early on in my business where I was a complete buffoon. I was impatient. I was short-tempered. I was in my own world. And, you know, I think that, you know, I was working so hard and focused so much on my business. I would just come home exhausted and just didn't have any gas left in the tank. So I don't think it's worth sacrificing. That was a bad decision on my behalf. I regret that. There was a period of time, I'm going to guess it was 5 or so years, where I barely remember, you know, anything from home. I don't remember what my kids were doing. I had hardly any relationship with them or my wife at all during those periods of time. And that was a tragic mistake. If I had a do-over button in life, I would go back and do those years over again. The reason is because it was not necessary. I didn't have to be like that. If I would have brought them into my life instead of pushing them out of my life, I think I would have been even better at my job and had more success. So what
woke you up to it? How did you realize that you were that way, and how did you change? Not everyone sees it.
To me, I think it was just an age thing, Steve. I woke up one day and I was however old I was, and I just started to appreciate life more. And, you know, there had been some tragedies around me, and if some people died and were divorced and, you know, those sorts of things. And they just all kind of coalesced at a period of my life. And it just made me step back and say, hey, wait a second. This life we have here is pretty short, and we only get one of them. I really better make it count. And, you know, so I was able to, like, you know, really successfully reconnect with my family, my brothers, mom and dad, you know, some of my close friends that I had kind of ignored over the years. Luckily, they all welcomed me back with open arms. So I think it was just, you know, kind of a realization that it wasn't, you know, it just wasn't worth the sacrifice, you know, because of how short life is. And now I have a real lesson on how short life can be, you know, staring me right in the face right now. And so every moment, you know, is so vital, you know, to me at this time. And I guess if I was going to give advice to people out there, I would just, and this is so often repeated, it sounds boring, but, you know, you just have to take, like, every moment, every day as precious as it could be, and live it to its fullest, and, you know, just really enjoy it. I wish I could have a do-over button on those years. I sure do.
Yeah, and it makes me also think of in the situation you are now with the future uncertain. You can also maybe run the risk of each thing or each day being too big a deal, because, you know, everything can't be, you know, epic, you know, it's got to be, you got to just enjoy the quiet moments of life and the day-to-day things that aren't looked at as being, you know, big and exciting.
Yeah, that's a great point. Every day can't be epic. I'm going to keep that in mind. You know, to me, an epic day now is a pretty simple day. It might involve a glass or two of wine, but if I have 3 glasses of wine and try to make it a really epic day, Steve, I'll feel like I got hit by a car, you know, tomorrow morning.
Yeah.
Anyway, you just got to take them as they come and enjoy the moments. You know, it's interesting now. I find myself, I drive a little bit slower. I'm way more patient. I'm way more friendly to the people in the checkout line. You know, all those sorts of things, you know, so it's not one big epic moment. It's a series of enjoyable small moments that make for a good day right now. And we do have some epic moments from time to time, and hopefully I have a lot more of those coming my way, but I've got to add them all up and just make it all count.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, the chemo you mentioned earlier just sounds like hell. How do you control the fear as you enter into that round of treatment every time?
My approach to it is, if you're a sports guy, and I think you are,
yeah,
and many listening are, it's kind of like the approach is like, it's the big game. You know, we're playing our crosstown rival. We're playing the best team in the league. And, you know, you have to play a good game to have a chance to win. And, you know, there's going to be a lot of pressure on you. And a lot of adversity that you're going to have to face down, you know, to get the victory. And that's the best analogy I could give to how I approach this. You know, it's just, you got to kind of psych yourself up for it and keep your eye on the prize that hopefully someday you'll be cured. And this is just a step in that process. And I found that if I approach it that way, you know, that I'm successful at getting through it. There are, it's just an amazing psychological study for me, at least, that how your body feels and how your mind reacts to that and the way they move in tandem. Like when I'm feeling really bad, you catch me like the third or fourth day after chemo session, like, you know, I get it why people quit chemo. I mean, I totally understand it because it really sucks. I mean, it is as dark can be. You know, but if you just sort of just, you know, back to the leadership thing, you know, and how we built this company and how you build a family and whatnot, you just put one foot in front of the other. Like, I just got to keep it going for one more minute. And then the minute after that, and then the minute after that. And that's how I get through it. That and the support system, you know, are essential.
Yeah. And you mentioned that you've always been an athlete and an exercise guy. So what does exercise do for you now? Is it, does it serve a different purpose than it did before?
It does, man. I don't know what kind of color you allow on your podcast here, Steve, but it's like sort of the big middle finger to cancer to me.
Yeah. No, that's totally okay. Go for it. Say whatever you want to say.
Yeah, this isn't Joe Rogan. I've used different words, but
yeah.
It's, you know, I get on the Peloton, I ride as hard as I can. It's not anywhere near as hard as, like, in terms of wattage and output that I could do 6 months ago, but I give it my all. I try to do strength training. You know, I a couple of weeks ago was able to do 55 consecutive push-ups. That's like a personal record. Yesterday I did 45 push-ups and 9 pull-ups, you know, just kind of, I just try to, like, I get, it's like I said, it's just, you know, it's my way of saying, you know, not today.
Yeah. It doesn't sound like a cancer guy.
I probably maybe overdid it a little bit yesterday. Cause then I went, planted a bunch of stuff out in the garden and went, hit some golf balls and went to a cookout at my neighbor's house. So I was in bed pretty early last night, but you know, I feel like a good full day and a very enjoyable day.
You know, besides losing the battle with cancer, what's your biggest fear?
Oh man. You know, I think my biggest fear is that, you know, what's going to happen to my family and my kids and that sort of thing, you know, how's their life going to turn out and missing out on, you know, those moments when the first grandchild is born or one of them gets married or heck, one of them graduates from college and gets their first job, you know, just sort of missing out on those things. I think about those. I think about just like playing golf and, you know, bike riding and playing volleyball with my buddies and, you know, just sort of missing out on those things and being with my family and on vacations. You know, we have a vacation the week after next. The whole family is coming to a big house we rented out in Western Maryland on a lake out there. And, you know, there's just times with mom and dad and just hanging out with my brothers and my sister and, you know, just those little things. I'm not a very complicated guy. I mean, I do like my complicated things, but, to me, a good time, Steve, is just sitting around with a glass of wine, listening to music and having really good conversation with people. I mean, I love that. I don't need to travel. I don't need to like be entertained. I just need people around me to like to talk about big ideas. And I'm all about that. So I really fear missing out on that.
Yeah. Yeah. I can only imagine. Thanks for sharing that with us. Yeah. So, usually at this point in the interview, we kind of say, from a leadership perspective, give us a pearl of wisdom. What's your pearl of wisdom you can leave with us today?
I think the pearl is, it's influence. I think that we as leaders so often underestimate the amount of influence that we have, you know, that what we say and what we do is noticed by people and it really matters to people. And even the little things that you go out of your way to do are noticed by people, and paying attention and treating everybody kind of fairly and equitably from that perspective is, I think, a real essential part of leadership. I think if anything, that's one thing that I've been pretty good at over the years. And I would encourage everybody to, you know, just really kind of get their head around that, wow, like, you as a leader are on stage and people do notice what you do, and it is meaningful to them. And they want to know, you know, really what you think and how you feel. And that helps guide them and their behavior. And that's part of what makes an organization successful.
Well, I think, Jeff, that you've obviously done a very good job of what you just described, because I think that's why people have come to you and rallied around you and shown the love that that I know it means a lot to you today. So I just want to say you've been very brave to come on the show and share some of these deep feelings and deep things you're going through right now. And I knew it was a big ask to ask you to come on here and expose yourself like that. So mm-hmm. I just want to thank you. And I think we can learn a ton from it. And so I really appreciate on the show today. And I wish you the best of luck. And if anyone can do it, you can.
Well, thanks, Steve. And I just want to take just one selfish moment here and say thanks to the people who are listening or who will listen to this, who have reached out to me. It's an amazing source of strength, and I'm very, very grateful for all that they've done. And I mean, we could have an hour-long podcast on just kind of what people have done for me in the last 4 months or so. It's just been so humbling, and I'm just eternally grateful for it. So thank you. And thanks for this opportunity. I'm a big fan of yours and really happy to be on your podcast.
Well, thanks, Jeff. Have a good rest of your day. Remember, just drink good wine and listen to good music and everything will go forward, right?
That's right. We're drinking nothing but good wine right now. Trust me.
Okay. Thanks, Jeff. Take care. And thanks again for being on our show today.
My pleasure. Have a good day, Steve. Thank you.
Thank you for tuning in to another episode of Profiles in Leadership. To hear the entire series of interviews, search iTunes Podcasts for Profiles in Leadership with Steve Anderson. To view videos of many of my interviews, search YouTube for Profiles in Leadership with Steve Anderson. You can also visit my website, which is orange.coaching.com, and that's orange, the word, .coaching.com, and go to the Media Center, where all episodes of the video and podcast episodes are available.